So as we get going this morning, we showed a similar picture to this at the top last week, and when Victoria spoke. This is, for those of you who may not have been able to make it, this is called The Pretty Place. It is a chapel at a YMCA camp on the border between North and South Carolina. Rose and I and Chris and Victoria had the pleasure of being able to visit on our recent road trip down to Florida. And let me tell you, every time I look at this photo, I stand in awe of the wonder of God and the beauty of what he's created. As we were entering this chapel, there are some people around, they have it open to the public, you can make a donation. The picture doesn't do it justice, of course, but as we were walking in, the outdoor chapel was filled with the sound of music. And it was hard to tell where it was coming from at first, but as we got closer to the front, you could see that there were three or four college-age women who were singing Glory to God in Spanish. And if this scene wasn't powerful enough, right, that put it over the top. I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. We sat there. It was freezing, and we're from Maine, and it was still cold. But we sat there for a while. I mean, they sang song after song after song. And so I just want to use this as kind of the backdrop for what we've been talking about the last 3 weeks. And we're going to be talking about today. If you have been here the past few weeks, you may have thought to yourself, where in the world is that Scott Linscott guy? I mean, he says he's a pastor on the website. He hasn't been here. I don't know what's going on. Well, Scott has been on his annual snowbird session down south, visiting with family. I know that there was a trip to Disney World in there, right? And really seeking God's will for our church and our city as we go throughout the remainder of this year. Scott missed at least three snowstorms, so we couldn't let him get out of it too easy. Got back on Wednesday, right? So we walloped you yesterday. So there you go. So I hope that you enjoyed this heavy, wet, sticky snow. I know that there's a lot of kids who are going to be enjoying the snow after church, right? That was the one announcement we missed. It is the Westbrook Winterfest. That's going to be in the park. You may have seen them setting up on your way in. There's going to be sledding and food trucks and all those fun things. But in all seriousness, we're very thankful Scott and Robin have made it back to us safely, and we're eager to hear what God has put on their hearts over the next few months. Today, we have the task, though, of wrapping up the last 3 weeks as we make a pivot into some new themes that Scott had referenced and as we quickly are approaching Easter. 4 weeks ago, David kicked us off by talking about God's provision for us and what are the right questions that we need to ask ourselves and to seek answers to as we orient our hearts toward God and keeping an eternal mindset while walking through life, which seems to be a minefield oftentimes, latent with doubt and sin, but also with hope of what is to come. Next up was Brad, who walked us through the power of perspective and offered some observations about how the Apostle Paul, throughout his ministry, mastered the art of contentment, even in the most difficult of circumstances. Through Paul's missionary journeys, whether he was sailing across the sea, walking miles and miles and miles to his next destination, oftentimes with people on his tail, or being in prison, Paul mastered the power of perspective. Last week, we heard from Victoria, who talked about oneness, not only oneness in marriage, but in every relationship that we have. One of the most vivid images I remember last week was the triangle that Victoria had up on the screen. We're going to reference back to that a little bit later. But for those of you who didn't see it, we're talking about an equilateral triangle. Is that right? Is it an equilateral? Okay. Equilateral triangle. And we're talking about horizontal relationships. So say myself is on one side at the bottom and Rose is on the other. And then God is at the top. And so one of the most poignant things that Victoria had shared with us last week was how as she and Chris pursue God together and individually, they move up the sides of that triangle and they actually become closer together, right? And so that really stuck in my mind over the last week. And Victoria ended last week with the thought of surrendering to God things that he wants to set us free from in those horizontal areas of our life. And so that's what we're going to pick up today with the topic of surrender. This topic, surrendering the things that we feel may separate us from God, was really placed in my heart when Rose and I were down on that trip in Florida a few weeks ago. This was a picture that we took from the balcony of our hotel room. And in times like this, I often find when the distraction of day-to-day life is completely stripped away, right? You don't have to do the dishes. You don't have to think about, you got to think about what you're going to eat, but you don't have to think about how you're going to cook it, right? So you pull those things away, work, childcare, whatever it may be, you pull those things back. In this time, we were able to acutely see the impact of the day-to-day slog, right, on our marriage and us individually. I've been pondering and praying a lot about how easy it is for us to feel separated from God individually, but also be separated from one another because of the things of this world and the things that we do. You often hear the daily grind, so to speak, the day in, day out, things that we do, our routines of every day, be referred to as a treadmill or a hamster wheel. The world tells us to run the race that is set before us straight to Dunkin' Donuts, right? Because America runs on Dunkin'. But really, the world prescribes that we must work hard for everything. Nothing comes without a cost. But the world doesn't know what the race we're told to run is and what the posture of our heart should be while we're doing so. They've co-opted this idea. That notion that the world has co-opted is found in Hebrews 12, starting in verse 1, and reads, "Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Now, who are these witnesses that you might ask that the author is referring to? Well, in the prior chapter, the author outlines all the things that Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Joseph, and Moses did by faith. Also known and commonly referred to as the Hall of Heroes. All of the previous chapter says all these people were still living by faith when they died. And I hope that the same is to be said for us upon the departure from this life. So the world has a lot to say about separation, and I'm not talking about being 6 feet apart. We've heard a lot about that, right, the last couple of years. We're talking about separation horizontally and vertically. We're going to start off today by talking about separation first, and then we're going to end by talking about surrender. By a show of hands, has anybody ever heard of 6 degrees of separation, the small world theory? Anybody? Yeah? Okay. So we're going to go through it a little bit just as a frame of reference. This theory is formally known as the small world theory, but commonly known as 6 degrees of separation, is the idea that every person in the world can be connected by just 6 degrees, so 6 other people. I've always found this concept to be extremely fascinating, right, ever since a young age. We're going to start by looking at the history of where this comes from. Sociologist and author Duncan Watts, quoted in the Harvard Business Review back in 2003, stated that the notion of 6 degrees of separation grew out of the work conducted by social psychologist Stanley Milgram in the 1960s, not that long ago. Milgram decided to investigate the so-called small world problem the hypothesis that everyone on the planet is connected by just a few intermediaries. In this experiment, a few hundred people from Boston and Omaha tried to get a letter to a target, a complete stranger in Boston. So this test group of people was trying to get a letter to a person they did not know in Boston. They could only send the letter to a personal friend whom they thought would somehow be closer to the target than they were. Very interesting. When Milgram looked at the letters that reached the target, he found that they had changed hands only about 6 times. And thus, this theory was born, right? It's come into our popular society. While the science behind this theory has been tested time and time and time again, and the exact number of degrees of separation may not exactly be 6, I've really been in awe of the theory since childhood. We're going to run through an example just for fun. So this is me. This is Rose and I. This is right after I get back from Afghanistan. And I've been in the military 11 years next week, and we're still doing it, so life is good there. The other gentleman on the screen is Major General Douglas Farnham. He is the Adjutant General of the Maine National Guard. He's appointed by the governor of Maine as the head of the military in the state of Maine. General Farnham was Colonel Farnham when I joined the military and was my wing commander in Bangor. So we've been acquainted for quite some time. Now, what does General Farnham have to do with this? General Farnham knows this guy, General Hokanson. As the head of the Maine National Guard, General Farnham is charged with going to these big meetings in D.C. and representing the interests of the state of Maine and the National Guard in Maine. General Daniel R. Hokanson is the chief of the National Guard Bureau. He's responsible for all Air and Army National Guard assets and units across the country. And General Hokanson is appointed by the President of the United States. How about that? Okay, so we're getting somewhere, right? He wasn't appointed by this president, but he obviously knows him because he's in meetings with him all the time. Every president, as you might imagine, has a vast network of people they're acquainted with. But our current president had the honor of hosting the GOAT, Tom Brady, right? When they won it in July 2021 to celebrate the Tampa Bay Buccaneers Super Bowl 55 victory. Now, I know it wasn't us, okay? But still, he was there. He knows Tom Brady. And that will get us where we're looking to go. So at this point, it's 5 degrees, right? Me, General Farnham, General Hokanson, the president, and the GOAT. So that's 5. One step further. This next photo is going to be a flashback. In 2004, at the ESPY Awards, Tom Brady was seated next to none other than Maverick, Tom Cruise. How about that? So that's me to Tom Cruise. No way. Oh, man. Oh, dream come true, right? That's pretty cool. As you might have observed through this little experiment we've done, the small world theory is based primarily on your acquaintances. So that's the premise of the connections. While it's interesting to contemplate that I'm only 6 degrees away from Tom Cruise, at the end of the day, I'll likely never meet Tom, nor the 3 people before him in that chain. As I was pondering this experiment a few weeks ago, I came to the conclusion that at the end of the day, I truly am separated from the majority of the people on that list. A few days later, during my prayer time, the point of this experiment clicked for me. While I may be able to connect myself to some random stranger through 6 other people, I'm not a random stranger to God. And there's nothing that separates me from him and his love for me. Jesus reminds us of this in Luke 12, verse 6 through 7. He was speaking to a crowd that is told to have been comprised of many thousands. When we're looking at how many people are described in the Bible to be somewhere, typically the people that are counted were at that time were men, right? And so if there are many thousand men, then there were also likely women and children there as well. So this is a very, very thousands upon thousands of people. Jesus said to the crowd, "Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs on your head are all numbered. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." I don't know about you, but I remember two times I've committed to memory as a child, right, in Sunday school, trying to count the hairs on my head. I can remember going like that, right? It's easier for some of us than others. But seriously, when I was a kid and taught this verse in Sunday school, I feel like we all reached up and started doing the same thing, right? Eventually, I gave up on this seemingly impossible task, right? I'd get to probably 30 and be like, I don't know how we're supposed to do this. The reality is that God knows all of us in such finite detail that even we have a difficult time comprehending. Not only are we known in this way by God, but we are also loved. You see, we as humans are so focused on self-preservation. That's the gospel that our society preaches. I think it can be so acutely seen in the walls that we build up in our relationships, our horizontal relationships with others. For the rest of our conversation today, we are going to walk through a minefield together. There are a lot of offensive weapons that are used by the military in war, tanks, guns, planes, etc. However, one that is unlike most others in the arsenal is landmines. The purpose of these mines in conventional warfare is to fortify a perimeter. Often planted outside the fence line at a military facility, these mines are designed to create some standoff distance and to notify friendly forces of the unassuming enemy who steps on it. Minefields are known to be some of the most dangerous places in the world. One false step could be the difference between life and death. While the practice itself is quite controversial, we're going to set that to the side and just talk about it as a metaphor today. For the purpose of this metaphor, our life when we were born is a green, luscious meadow like you see before you. There's a point on the road where my in-laws live. It's about a quarter mile up the road from their house on the top of this hill, and we call it the thoughtful spot. The reason why it's called the thoughtful spot is because that's where we used to walk the dog to, right? Thoughtful spot. Anyway, and so it's at the top of this hill. On both sides of the road are vast fields in the foreground with towering mountains behind. It is absolutely stunning. This is the meadow that comes to mind for me. As we walk through life and have difficult experiences and seasons that none of us are immune to or could possibly anticipate, mines get planted in our horizontal minefield between us and other people. These mines are designed to keep others away from the hurt that we've experienced and to avoid re-experiencing that trauma. We intentionally or unintentionally plant them for the purpose of self-preservation. Because in reality, we do have a fear that if we let people in, they'll navigate the minefield, right, to get close to us, and eventually they will unintentionally step on a mine, causing us to revisit the reason why we placed it there in the first place. This can, as Victoria mentioned last week, lead to potential isolation. Sometimes in our horizontal relationships, and we're gonna talk more about the vertical relationship mostly for the rest of our time, but just briefly, in our horizontal relationships, it's important to note that sometimes we don't know those mines are there until we hit them ourselves, right? So this is a great example. I love Chick-fil-A. I every time, for the longest time, because I go to Bangor for the military, right, I'd go to Chick-fil-A because it was the only one in the state. I have eaten in the dining room at Chick-fil-A many times. But it was a couple months ago. We were going to a show. We went to Chick-fil-A, Rose and I. We went in there, and we sat down, we got our food, and it's frankly can be kind of a train wreck in there, right? There's like anywhere between 15 and 20 people standing there waiting for their food, right? I myself, knowing me, can get some spatial anxiety, right? I like to be able to sit where I can see the door, right? I like to just speak it based on some of my military experience. So as I was in there, we were sitting down eating dinner. I was very uncomfortable because there were multiple people who got their order wrong, right? So what happens when you get your order wrong? The Jesus chicken that we ordered, right? It gets a little tense, right? You walk up, hey, ma'am, I don't know why my order is wrong, you know, and it's like two, three, four people in a row. And it's like, that makes me very uncomfortable. Part of the reason why is because in my military training, we're supposed to defuse those types of situations, right? And so I was very uncomfortable. I didn't know that was going to happen when I walked in there, right? I did not know that I was going to have this reaction. And so ever since that day, Chick-fil-A is car food, right? We eat it in the car so we don't have to interact with other people. And that's fine. It's still delicious. I still love it. But the point of the story is that sometimes you don't know until you hit it, right? So, a couple things. In your horizontal relationships, be gentle with one another, right? So when we're like reflecting on the fruits of the Spirit, gentleness is the application here. Right? Because sometimes they don't know, the person that you're talking to, what is going to trigger that until they hit it, right? And so gentleness is something we need to exercise in our horizontal relationships. And also, it's not your job to dig up other people's minds, right? So that is the job of the Holy Spirit, okay? So that we're gonna leave our horizontal relationships there, and we're gonna focus on our vertical relationship with God. In our vertical relationship with God, we also place minds in a field, in the field that He's created, causing us to perceive that we are separated from God. When in the reality is there's nothing that can separate us from God, right? But this is how we may feel that we are separated from God because of these things, right? And so as I was contemplating this concept, a few minds that our culture predisposes us to place in this field, causing that perceived separation, came to mind. The first one was purpose. As we're running the race we talked about earlier, we often find ourselves running the race of the world, right? There are things that the world prescribes that we need to do daily, weekly, etc. Honestly, when I think of purpose as it relates to running, I feel like I'm on a treadmill in the trenches sometimes, right? I'm running in the same place. I don't seem to be going anywhere. It's a dark place because we're in a trench, and I just keep on running in the same place. We fix our eyes on what the world says success looks like, and we spend a significant amount of time and energy making it look like to others that we have it all together. That we know exactly what we're doing and are confident that no matter what lies ahead, we'll be successful, right? So that's the outward persona that we display. We spend so much time running on this treadmill in the trenches that we become like a camera out of focus. We lose that perspective that Brad shared with us a couple weeks ago. However, we've got to go back to who gives us this purpose and who is the source of life. And as we're running the race, we need to fix our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, right? Like we were talking about earlier. Some versions say the author and perfecter of our faith. All our energy should be spent running closer to Him. And sometimes I feel like we just seem to be running the wrong race. The second mind I thought of was control. As we're running, we want to maintain precise control, especially on a treadmill. I don't know. So I'm not an avid runner. I have to run as a part of necessity because I have to take a PT test for the military. And sometimes, I don't know if you had this feeling when you're running on the treadmill, you're like, if I fall, this is going to be really bad, right? Like if I just, if one falls, you know? So you've seen the videos, American Funny, some videos. So as we're running, we want to maintain that precise control, right? If you think about running the race, the most people think that the most important thing to focus on is time. The runner's time. If the runner doesn't make their split times, right, similar to a bike race, right, if you don't make your splits, you're not going to make your goal, and you won't finish at your desired time. while split times are one of the most important aspects in the runner's while the runner is doing this race, one of the other important things that is forgotten about is their heart rate. If the runner is unable to keep their heart rate under control, they will not have the stamina to finish the race that they've set out to run. If we're really being honest with ourselves, I think that we live in a world that tells us we're in control of our own destiny. And as long as we live our truth, right, happiness is going to await us at the end. Trying to live my truth can be really difficult sometimes. And you know, I think the most difficult it can be is in traffic. I'm trying to live my truth while merging onto the highway. And John Doe, driving an F-350 from Massachusetts, is living his truth by not letting me in. Because John doesn't let people in when they're merging on the highway. Right? So you can see how this can be problematic. We put this mind so deep in the ground, firmly trying to be in control of everything, when in reality, in the abstract, we're in control of nothing. The truth is that we can only control our words and actions and how we respond to the circumstances that we encounter. We can only control the posture of our heart as we move through those circumstances. We hang on to control so tightly that we often forget to submit ourselves to God, who is in control of everything. Romans 8:28 says, "And now we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." Because God is working things together for the good of those who love him, we are released from the burden and the defense mechanism of control, and this becomes uprooted in light of this truth. The third one, as you might have guessed, there are going to be six degrees of separation, is technology. And this one, you know, you may not think of it, but I don't know about you. As I was praying through writing this sermon, I was thinking about this. I feel like the word notification used to mean something more important than it does now, right? So you get home. Just paint this picture. You get home from work. You check the mail. You open it. You got a letter. So, oh boy, it's from the government. Great. You open it. At the top, it says, "You have been duly notified that you've been selected for jury duty." Ugh, right? You have been notified, right? That is what notification used to mean. I don't know about you, but I feel like I am inundated with notifications all day long. Emails, text messages, notifications from my bank, messages in my work group chat, ESPN telling me that the Bruins just broke another record. You know, I feel like I'm just constantly inundated. In this world of constant connection, it feels like we are constantly being notified of something, but not truly being filled with anything. The only thing that's able to truly fill us is our relationship with God. I personally have had a bad habit for a while that was recently exacerbated during the pandemic, reading the news while in bed, right? For some people, it's their social media newsfeed. For me, Apple News, they got me. You know, it's so convenient, right? They have Reuters, Politico, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, all right there. I don't need a subscription, and they aggregate it all for me and present it in a pretty package. Ah, it's great. You know, I'm a fairly inquisitive person, and I really enjoy learning new things. And that AI formula really has me down to a science. They always pitch me articles that they think will pique my interest, and 99% of the time, they're right. I think for a while there, I wasn't alone, though, right? The first thing that most of us were doing in the morning a couple years ago is checking our phone to see how many new COVID cases there were, right? Or how about checking to see if they got everybody out of Afghanistan? Or was Russia really going to invade Ukraine? They do that overnight? I was talking with a friend about this a few months ago and remarked that I need to know what's going on in the world because of my role in the military, but I'd really like to reclaim some of that time, right? And so In doing so, now, because the news doesn't fill me before bed, really is emptying. When I find myself reaching for my phone on my nightstand to scroll, I either put it down and pray, or I open my Bible app and read the devotional for the day. This is just one example of how technology provides us with endless entertainment that piques our interest and can fill us with information that is unhelpful, anxiety-inducing, or hurtful, but also, if used appropriately, can be used as a tool to draw us closer to God. The next one we're going to talk about is pride. Merriam-Webster's dictionary's primary definition of pride is the quality or state of being proud. I like that one, right? Man, that's a good one. I can get behind that, but if you scroll down three definitions, you will find that they also define pride as exaggerated self-esteem and behavior that reflects such an attitude, also known as cynicism. Ooh. Yeah, that one's a toughie. Pride, I think, it's in my mind field, and I would say it's probably in some of yours as well. This sense of pride feeds into our sense of control that we talked about earlier, right? So now our minds are connected in this field. When I experience an overwhelming sense of self-sufficiency, that I can handle anything, do it myself, I don't need anyone's help, this is the kind of pride that we're talking about. It takes away, when I become this person, it takes away the opportunity for other people to serve me, right? For me to humble myself and let somebody else serve me in this way. Additionally, when whatever I'm being prideful works out in my favor, it bolsters the notion of my mind. You see, God, I can do it myself anyway, all right? Look at what I just did. Look at what I just did. The truth is found in James chapter 4, where it's written, "Therefore, anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes the enemy of God. Or do you think Scripture says without reason that he jealously longs for the Spirit and has caused it to dwell in us? But he gives us more grace. This is why Scripture says God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble." The truth is that when I'm prideful, I stand in opposition to God. This mind of pride is also deeply rooted in the themes of our society, the pull yourself up by the bootstraps culture. We're taught this mentality by the world at such a young age. In reality, when I lay down my pride and humble myself before the Lord, I'm submitting to his direction for my life. And that is exactly what we're called to do. Two more. Work. This is a tough one. I think it's so ingrained in our culture that work is equal to worth. You've probably heard the Max Fisher quote, "Find something you love and do it for the rest of your life." Yeah, it's a pretty popular one. Our society oftentimes ties an individual's worth to their work. Like, there's a certain level of prestige that goes along with being a banker as opposed to being a barista. We often interpret how valuable a person is in our society by the function they play, not who they are as a person. Now, some would tell you falsely that God's love is based on your works, and what you do is the test by which salvation is rendered. The reality is, that's not true. The love of God cannot be earned through your actions and works, but it's freely given to those who've called upon his name. The last one is time. There are a few well-known phrases about time that came to mind as I was preparing for this morning. The one quote, though, that I wanted to share is from Benjamin Franklin. It's the, "Remember, time is money." Anybody ever heard that? Time is money. This quote's been attributed to Benjamin Franklin years after he actually wrote it, in an essay titled "Advice to Young Tradesmen," which was written in 1748. To reframe that information for a moment, young men in the global West have been told since 1748 that their time is equivalent to money. It is really interesting thought experiment to think about the sentiment of that statement and how it's permeated our society. It's permeated our society in a couple different ways. One that came to mind in our instant gratification era was that we want everything now and are willing to spend more money in shipping to have something arrive at our house 2 days earlier than the free rate, because time is money, right? However, I would like to tweak this centuries-old quote just a smidge and see how that changes our perspective. What if remember time is money was changed to remember time is valuable? I think that is, in essence, the sentiment that Franklin is trying to convey here. When you look at it in that way, I think that we all resonate with our time being valuable to us individually, but our time is also valuable to God. As we're running through the race of life, we'll often need to stop for a water break. The New York Marathon course, a piece of trivia for us, is 26.2 miles long, which shouldn't surprise anybody because it's a marathon. It's 26.2 miles. That's what we're talking about here. There's a water station every mile between miles 3 and 25, meaning that there are 22 opportunities for participants to get a cup of water along the route. What we do with our water breaks in life or our idle moments during the flurries of activity matter to God. We talked about a couple times in the Acts study that takes place here on Monday evenings of the importance of making a routine to ensure that you are spending time with God on a consistent basis. Often we use this landmine as a barrier to our closeness with God by saying we just don't have time to do a quiet time, to sit in silence and pray with God. I'd been feeling the same way throughout the fall last year, that I had so many folks that I wanted to pray for, but I seldom took the time to do it. I think we've talked about before how in our culture, you know, when somebody shares something difficult with you, when you come into church, you say, hi, how are you? You want the response to be, good, and then you go sit down, right? You did, like, you know, so and it can sometimes feel very transactional, or somebody shares something with you, like, I'm going to pray for you, right? How often do we actually do that? Right? And so I found for me that this was an issue. How could I carve out some time to spend with God in prayer? The really obvious answer was my morning commute to work. We previously established that I like to stay informed, right? I like to listen. I like to read the news while I also consume it over the radio. Or that was my habit. I'll listen to the news in the car on the way to work. And instead of doing that, now, I pray. From the time I get on the highway to the time I get off, it's 18 minutes, I now give to God, and I truly have to say that I feel a lot better when I arrive at work. Walking in there as opposed to whatever the news had spewed at me as on my way into work, and I'm worried about all these different things that are going on in the world. As the worship team comes and we begin to close our time together, through prayer, I was really convicted that truly in all of these six areas, purpose, control, technology, pride, work, and time, six things we put in place as perceived barriers between us and God. Remember, there's nothing that separates us from God. The truth is, nothing, none of these, and others I'm sure that we could think of together, separate us from him. And he aims through our sanctification to start clearing some of those minds. First, though, we have to be willing to surrender these to God as a part of our sanctification as we yearn for closeness with him. By remembering the purpose for the race that we're running, keeping an eternal focus. By recognizing that God is in control and by not letting technology be a barrier preventing a relationship of closeness with God, but using it as a tool to support that relationship. By humbling ourselves before the Lord, by knowing that we do not need to earn God's favor and love, but that it is freely given to those who love him, and by setting aside time intentionally to spend with God while he works in our hearts, I think that we'll see this meadow begin to be reclaimed and restored. We're going to end with a song today that talks about the joy of living life on the foundational truths found in the gospel, and that no matter the circumstances, God won't fail. One of the most important things, though, as we prepare to sing this song and go throughout our week, I think we need to remember is that clearing these minds by surrendering these things that we've placed that make us feel like we're separated from God when in reality we're not, takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. And even when some of these feelings, you know, have been resolved, they may come back. So I just encourage you to ask God in your prayer time to show you areas in your life where these can start to be cleared in order for you to continue to grow in him. But one thing that we do know for sure, because of our faith in the triune God, we stand on a firm foundation, and God will never.